This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writers Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of the New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. No modern president has ever been convicted on impeachment charges. Richard Nixon resigned before the vote ever took place. Bill Clinton was impeached, but he was acquitted in the Senate, and his popularity went up. What will happen with this wildly unpredictable presidency, the Trump presidency, is pure conjecture. Every day brings a new revelation, a new turn. There are so many big questions about what's going on right now, and we're going to tackle at least a few of them with some of the writers who are covering the situation for The New Yorker. We'll start with Susan Glasser, a veteran of D.C. politics who writes our weekly column on Washington in the Age of Trump. I reached her on Skype.
Hi, this is Susan.
Hey, Susan, it's David. How are you?
Hey, great.
I'm sorry to interrupt your lunch, but I can't help but ask, what is the mood like in Washington this week? It seems to me like it hasn't been this way in a very long time.
You know, I saw somebody referring to it as Shocktober, which is pretty silly. But Washington has these weeks, days when the wheels feel like they're coming off. And that's usually in the early days of a scandal or investigation when tons of information starts to break free. And I feel like usually, you know, it could end up being wrong, but usually in Washington, there's a pretty strong conventional wisdom and people have a sense of how the politics of something are going to shake out. And here you will run into people who will allow that they could see it both ways, that the beginning of impeachment could be the day that Donald Trump won re-election. And, you know, you can get Democrats who tell you that and yet nonetheless feel they need to proceed. You can have Republicans say the opposite, which is, you know, I know that's been the conventional wisdom, but we're really terrified that this is going to be awful for us.
Now, if I'm a congressional Republican, how do I see a decent outcome for me and the party here? Is there a template of defense that they can look to historically?
Well, they seem to be quite upset just that there's not been a more vigorous defense. And obviously, it does vary by district. But most of the Republicans right now, they aren't even defending Trump on the facts. There's a lot of shouting about the whistleblower, about a coup in progress. There's a lot of demands to investigate Joe Biden, to investigate Mueller and the basis on his report, basically to obfuscate and to throw up kind of chaff. But when you strip it away, it's interesting that they're not really defending Trump.
So there was a routine on Saturday Night Live in which there was a kind of typical Washington panel, you'll forgive me. And this one is saying it's a turning point and this is horrible and this is horrible. And this kind of wised up African-American academic says, yeah, but it's not going to matter. And there's sense in that. I mean, how many scandals have we had? We've had hush money payments to porn stars. We've had the Mueller report, which has 10 indications of possible obstruction of justice. This is now consigned to history, it almost seems. Is there any reason to believe that Donald Trump can't survive this?
look, I was really, really struck to your point. There's a new poll out today that's getting circulation here in Washington that would underscore this, a Monmouth survey that shows that 40% of Republicans believe that Trump raised the issue of investigating Joe Biden and his son in the phone call with the Ukrainian president, even though that is actually in the transcript that the White House itself released. So, I mean, propaganda works. Telling a lie over and over and over again, at least enough people start to believe it.
You asked on Twitter whether we should call this whole affair Ukraine-gate. Has anyone been able to come up with a name that works better yet?
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that. I was going to put that in my column this week. I got thousands of responses. Some of my favorite were moron Contra.
John Oliver says stupid Watergate.
Right. Stupid Watergate. A lot of people said that. Ukrainium won. My favorite response, though, was Monday. Because that's when I made the tweet on Monday.
Susan, thanks so much.
Thank you, David.
The only thing that matters is the transcript of the actual conversation that I had with the president of Ukraine. It was perfect.
Joshua Yaffa is a reporter who's usually based in Moscow, and he's been covering the Ukraine scandal from Kiev.
Hello.
Hey, Josh, how are you?
Hi, good, good.
It's good to talk to you. Not long ago, this country, the United States, was consumed with the question of whether Donald Trump sought Russia's help in influencing the 2016 election. And here we are talking about the president attempting to get Ukraine to influence the 2020 election. How do these two stories kind of nestle together?
Well, it all goes back to the counter-narrative that Trump and those around him tried to come up with as they were facing the allegations that grew out of the Mueller report about their and the campaign's interactions with various Russian entities. And it was the search for contradictory or exculpatory or diversionary stories that led them, the president and his allies, first and foremost Rudy Giuliani, to look to Ukraine. And it was there where Giuliani had told to him this conspiracy theory about Joe Biden and his son Hunter Biden and the former prosecutor general of Ukraine.
Now, when you're in the offices of Ukrainian officials these days and you're talking about these things, what is the kind of emotional valence that you're getting? They must feel like this is the last position that we want to be in, is in between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin, and it's the biggest rock and the biggest hard place imaginable.
That's exactly right. The first thing I think they feel is something between confusion and disappointment. After all, to the extent that American presidential administrations have put pressure on their counterparts in Kiev over the years, it's been essentially to strengthen rule of law, to keep politics out of the judiciary and the law enforcement system, to make sure that presidents weren't using or abusing the Ukrainian legal system for political benefit. And so this sad irony wasn't lost on anyone that now it was an American president who apparently was using his office to put pressure on his Ukrainian counterpart to use that country's judicial system for political ends. The roles were reversed, and that was certainly unexpected and I think quite dispiriting for a lot of Ukrainian officials who were used to, if they were going to get a lecture from their American counterparts, it was really to do the exact opposite.
Josh, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Lindsay was saying, I never knew you were so nice. That was a perfect conversation. I heard Rick Scott today say that was a perfect conversation. How can you impeach somebody on that conversation?
Jane Mayer is a veteran chronicler of Washington scandals going all the way back to Iran-Contra and maybe even a little bit before.
Hello?
Hey, Jane, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Jane, you've been in Washington for, you know, a few years, and you've been around for some scandals. Does this feel different?
Well, everything's different under Trump. It's just all a little bit wilder.
How do you mean?
usually when you have a scandal, you've got kind of an organized pushback coming back from, say, the White House. In this case, you've just got sort of a rain of crazy Twitters coming from the president, sort of calling his accusers names.
Yeah, I guess that is different.
there's no kind of organized effort here, it seems like. And some of the language that's coming from these tweets is really remarkably extreme.
Meaning so you treason, have the president, civil war, deep state, all the rest.
Absolutely. I mean, the word treason being used by a president, he is, as we know, basically what he's talking about is that the whistleblower, if he were treasonous, he's basically saying he should be killed. And so it has a kind of an unhinged feel.
Has the intelligence community turned on Trump? Is there any validity to that argument?
Well, I mean, by all accounts, the whistleblower comes out of the intelligence community. And if so, he's one of their own, and he played it by the book. And I think there's a pretty strong feeling within the intelligence community that it's threatening when the president is talking about treason and also about unmasking a member of the intelligence community. I mean, that's a kind of a serious affront to them. And so you've actually seen a number of key intelligence figures go on the air. Mike Morrell, for instance, who was acting director of the CIA, made a very careful but interesting appearance on television in which he basically supported the whistleblower.
Nothing can be certain about what the future holds for the Trump presidency, and I'm not asking you to predict too much, but the specter is coming of the possibility of something that you wrote about, President Pence. You wrote a long piece about Pence. Would a President Pence be at a policy level all that different from President Trump, you think?
Very different.
How so?
Pence is an ideologue. He's somebody who cares about policy, and he is a devout evangelical Christian. He cares about all of the issues that animate the religious right. He's, you know, very anti-abortion. He's had some very controversial views about gay rights. And he's also someone who's been in bed for most of his career with the big money in the Republican Party. And Trump has cast himself as independent of those big money donors. I mean, recently, since he's taken office, he's cozied up to them. But he ran against them as a populist. And Pence is very different. And I actually interviewed Steve Bannon at one point about Pence, and he surprisingly said to me he thought that a presidency in Pence hands, the White House would be controlled by the Kochs. It was a real concern. And that's
Koch
the
brothers.
Koch brothers, yeah. who are some of the biggest donors have been traditionally in the Republican Party. So Pence would be very different. He'd also work better with the Hill because he knows how Washington works.
In a way, Jane, these are early days, but is there a scenario that you think that the Senate turns on Donald Trump if articles of impeachment are brought to the Senate?
I mean, anything's possible. It doesn't look like that today. But, you know, people tell me on the Hill that a lot of Republicans in the Senate dislike Trump personally. What's holding them there is that he's got a hold on the base of the party whose votes they need. And if that changes, they'll change.
Now, in Watergate, Nixon's base of support shriveled to almost nothing. And as we famously remember, Republican leaders of the House and the Senate came to the White House and told them it was time to resign. Barry Goldwater, Hugh Scott, and all the rest. The world is different now, and the ability to retain your base through Fox News and social media and all the other instruments that didn't exist in 1974, that seems to indicate that it might be easier for Trump to hold on to the base to the bloody end.
Yeah, I mean, he has an alternative communications system, and Fox is a big part of that. And in fact, it's interesting because...
Although Fox seems to be fracturing.
Somewhat. Its news side is peeling off a little bit. But when Roger Ailes founded Fox, Roger Ailes, you have to remember, was a veteran of the Nixon administration. And he founded Fox partly in reaction to Watergate, saying, we're not going to let this happen again. Next time, we're going to have our own way of reaching our voters.
So that they could retain the base and survive something as bad as Watergate.
Right.
Jane, thanks so much.
Great to be with you.
I saw many of the senators talking about it, many of the congressmen talking about it. Not a thing wrong. Unless you heard the Adam Schiff version where he made up my conversation. He actually made it up. It should be criminal. It should be treasonous.
Hello.
Hey, Jelani.
Hey, how are you?
Jelani Cobb has covered justice and many other issues in the Trump era. He's a staff writer and a historian currently teaching at Columbia University. You know, in the last few days, Trump has accused his critics of treason, and he's made ominous remarks about punishment for the whistleblower, talk of civil war. Does any of this have any precedent in American history?
You know, I've thought about this, and I can't really find anything that compares. And the one thing that I say that's really interesting, though, about this, you know, the comparisons to the Civil War, is that, you know, in what he called, I think, a Civil War-like fracture, and a retweet of his. But the weird thing about that is that when we start talking about the Civil War, it takes us not to 1860, but to 1776, which is dynamics that were present at the beginning of the Republic, that there are various efforts over the course of decades to patch together and ultimately culminate in a fratricidal war nearly a century later. I don't think the fate of the Trump presidency is anywhere near that scale.
Jelani, if that was meant as a note of reassurance, I appreciate it, but shouldn't we take it seriously when the President of the United States says things about arresting people and incites violence at rallies and in his rhetoric?
Yeah, I do think that we should take it seriously. And I think that's been the kind of tricky line that people have tried to finesse since he's emerged as a public figure, which is, you know, clearly he has a tendency toward hyperbole, but that doesn't mean that we should completely ignore everything, the entire underlying sentiment. And so we've seen in his campaign rallies that he has the possibility of riling people up into, you know, committing acts of violence. We've seen that in other instances, people who are maybe unwell are inspired to other acts of violence. You know, I'm thinking about Cesar Sayoc and, you know, mailing pipe bombs to various people who he thought were critics or enemies of Donald Trump.
Sure.
That said, who knows where this is going to go? The thing that concerns me is not so much, you know, his potential to inspire violence as his capacity to actually author it.
Is that your greatest fear, that he is so unpredictable, and that's a mild word for it, impulsive, that he may react to this political crisis in a way that's even more dangerous than the crisis itself?
I think so. And one of the things I think that people on the left have found at least heartening, I guess, if that's the term we can use, about the Trump presidency is that he has been, you know, strikingly dovish in terms of his actual military engagements. But we also don't know what that volatile personality could do, especially we know that Trump is particularly attuned to humiliation, and that he seems to be really driven by any instance in which he perceives himself as being embarrassed and so on, what an impeachment might unleash in that kind of psyche, I have no idea, and I don't think any of us do.
Jelani Cobb, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Here's where I fooled them. They never thought I'd release the conversation. They never thought in a million years that I'd release the conversation.
Staff writer Jill Lepore is also a professor of history at Harvard University, and her recent book, called These Truths, is a survey of pretty much the entirety of American history. Jill, you recently wrote a kind of summa, a book on the full arc of American history. How do the things that President Trump is accused of lately compare to the allegations against previous presidents like Andrew Johnson, Richard Nixon, Bill Clinton?
They're very bad. But that's not what impeachment is for. You can't be impeached for being a creep or a bad president. And that's, I think, one of the things that's been tricky. So the question, you know, in the last week and a half has been, how much worse is this latest set of revelations?
And what do you make of the revelations? Do you think they're bad enough for articles of impeachment and possible conviction in the Senate?
I do. I do without hesitation. I think that in terms of the House, the articles of impeachment are not really a choice, but I think a duty that members of Congress have, a constitutional duty. what happens in the Senate is a different matter. I mean, it's easy to focus on individual senators and personalities in the state of the Republican Party, but the structural matters really do prevail here. It is a very high bar. It's going through a narrow window after climbing a very high ladder to get through conviction in the Senate. So I think that's why you kind of just see sort of people spinning around.
Well, has there been any fundamental historical change in the country which has enabled a president to be this brazen? Or was it just that his predecessors exercised more restraint? Or did they?
Well, impeachment is chiefly a deterrent, right? It's the gun on the mantle that not only never goes off, but people rarely even notice that it's there. Since there have only ever been, you know, 2.5 impeachments, we presume the presidents have always known that it's there, and it governs to some degree their tendency to abuse their own power. So Trump is an ungoverned person, right? Just as a human being, he doesn't govern himself. So it's not surprising that he's not deterred by the threat of impeachment, I think, and to the contrary, probably thrilled by it.
What is a good outcome here? Historically speaking, you describe the predicament we're in every manner. What's a good outcome here?
You're testing my optimism.
I you're always provisionally optimistic compared to so many other scholars and journalists. Yeah, I am testing it.
I wonder if we might gain as an electorate clarity about the powers of the presidency relative to the other branches of government. It is for those of us who teach civics and history, it's a really important moment to think about what are the checks against the power of the executive. You know, there's congressional oversight, there are elections, and there's impeachment. And if congressional oversight fails and the impeachable offense is interfering with elections by soliciting the aid of a foreign power, then really all you have left is impeachment. That actually, there's a lot of clarity, even in just understanding that that's the nature of the dilemma, the constitutional dilemma.
But more likely, I hate to say, but more likely is an outcome in which articles of impeachment are written. They go to the Senate. And the core of Trump's support does not shrivel, and therefore the senators act on that and dismiss these articles, make them go away, and he's still in office.
Mm-hmm. It was still the principled thing to do. It was still the obligation of the House to send those articles of impeachment to the Senate. And it will be the burden of history that lands on the shoulders of those senators. I mean, this is the presidential equivalent of shooting somebody on Fifth Avenue.
Jill Lepore, and we heard from Jelani Cobb, Jane Mayer, Josh Yaffa, and Susan Glasser. You can read all their reporting on the impeachment inquiry at newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name.
On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. In 40 years, nearly 100 million Americans will be of retirement age, something like a quarter of the population by that time. Staff writer Adam Gopnik has been reporting on how we're preparing or not preparing to live in an aging society.
Last August, two things happened to me. I turned 63, and so I decided to write something about aging. Now, I don't think of myself as old, but one of the things I discovered when I started reporting this piece is that no one thinks of himself or herself as old. We will all reject the label of being old no matter what it costs us in convenience. If you have a device that is especially helpful to the elderly, one thing you can be sure of is that no elderly person will ever buy it. That's the paradox of aging, which governs the whole realm of geriatrics. A couple of months ago, I went to visit the group of people who, perhaps more than anyone else in America, are spending all their time thinking about aging. They are software engineers, urban planners, public health researchers, just a whole slew of specialists who work together at this center in Cambridge, Massachusetts, called the MIT Age Lab.
The feel, the vibe of this place is very sort of, you know, George Jetson. Everyone's at their desk at their carrel. There's the famous Japanese robotic seal. It's a wonderful help to Alzheimer's patients and so on.
Hello.
The Age Lab offers a whole range of products and ideas, but I was there to try a special suit that the lab has made. The suit mimics the physical conditions of aging. Samantha Brady bundled me into it.
So, to start the aging process, we're going to put a weighted vest on first.
All right. This is to feel what it would be like to gain. How many pounds is this?
This is 10 pounds, but this is actually not that you're necessarily going to gain weight, but muscle loss.
Oh, right.
It's very common.
Kind of feel. So yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Everything at the Age Lab has a name. It's part of its charm. And the suit is called Agnes, which in this amazing, very MIT acronym, stands for Age Gain Now Empathy System. It's a composite snarl of bungee cords and weights and restrictive clothing. It's got limitless amounts of Velcro and a good number of snaps, and it took me a full 15 minutes just to get it on.
All right, so the more muscle loss weights come on now.
Yes, so now we're going to go with the ankle weights.
All right.
So these are about 4 to 5 pounds each.
And they wrap right around.
One of the really startling things the Agnes suit provides are these kinds of numbing Crocs that you put on your feet, which very skillfully imitate the loss of sensory feeling in your foot pads that can cause the slower shuffle many elders walk with.
All right, let's go to Joe's office. All right, now I can blame Joe. I may kill Joe at this point.
Joe Coughlin, who's the creator of this monstrous suit, is the head of the lab.
Wow. Oh, my goodness.
Looking a little different now.
Yeah, I'll say.
So,
he's a fellow boomer in significant good health still. I don't know if he's a particularly fast walker, but once I put on the Agnes suit, I did start to notice how goddamn sprightly he seemed by contrast.
Moving a little slower, perhaps?
Slower, and the really weird thing is that one's gait, it's the interface with the ground. I know that sounds like a weird thing to be troubled by.
Yeah. We also make the mistake quite often that older adults are naturally slower. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're not slower. It's that lack of flexibility and ability to take a wide step
that is
making them slower.
Right. Well, let's walk a bit, Nick. Okay. Let's do a test. I want to find out what this is like. And oh, my goodness, this is so aggravating.
Joe Coughlin springs down the hallway, and I follow, an aging, Lear-like figure trudging along behind him. We get to this kind of faculty lounge, this an area with a coffee machine. It's a very fancy coffee machine. It's got a touch screen where you order the kind of coffee you want. Kaufman wanted me to try working this touch screen on the coffee machine because as the world we're living in becomes increasingly digital, touch screens abound, and they present certain challenges for the aging.
Well, look at this. So here's the...
Now, actually, this is a fun thing to think about. So look at the coffee machine we've got here. I want you to navigate that coffee machine to pour yourself a cup of coffee. And by the way, even your hands change as we age. With less moisture, the touch screens are, shall we say, less forgiving.
Oh, is that right? Yep. Yes, I feel that already.
So here's
Hit small. I'll do regular. Go.
Joe Coughlin tells me that the problem isn't just my newly, if artificially, gnarled hands. It's really about the way we design the entire world around us.
Trying to grasp a hot beverage in your hand is worrying.
Well, think about this. Now, that cup is thinner because we're trying to save on paper.
Right.
Plastic bottles have gotten thinner because we're trying to be eco-friendly. Ironically, that very thing that is being more environmentally friendly is not very gray-friendly. You've got to squeeze it to get a grip on it. So as a result, you'll often take a bath trying to open up the water, or you may get the hot coffee all over you.
I can feel it. It's really difficult to do that, and it's irksome because you worry, I could spill this. And that would be it.
So one of the things that often comes up with using Agnes with all kinds of companies around the world is that people say, well, why don't you just ask older people? Why don't you just watch? And the answer is we do, and we do watch. But here's the difference. Older folks want to cope. They also don't want to admit, if you will, that they are having difficulty. And the other thing is an engineer, a designer, whatever, will know that that can be fixed easily rather than somebody saying, well, heck, I'm 80 years old. That's what it means to be 80 years old. They're as much a victim of the story as the designer who's designing something they think is old age.
They're trapped with the narrative, too, because they think, oh, well, I guess life is just like this now.
15 years from now, only 15, people of retirement age will outnumber children for the first time in American history. Wearing the Agnes suit makes me realize just how everything in our built environment is designed for the young. That's why Coughlin built the Agnes, the aging suit, so that we can empathize in our lived experience with what it's like to be old. Maybe even more importantly, he also organized a focus group of older people, all aged 85 or above, who come in every month to talk to researchers at the Age Lab about what the lived experience of age is like. Coughlin calls them, charmingly, the lifestyle leaders. My producer, Caroline Lester, went with two of the members on their way to a meeting at MIT.
I'll be right down. I'll buzz you into the lobby.
Jean lives independently in her own apartment. She's lived there for decades, and for the most part, it suits her needs. A few years ago, she fitted her ceilings with these kinds of thin, rectangular boxes that deaden all the ambient noise.
I'm almost 95, a few weeks, and I had these put in for soundproofing recently. My hearing is so lousy. I was just surrounded by what they call surround sound.
Jean and her friend John, also a nonagenarian, are part of the Lifestyle Leaders Group at the Age Lab.
Here he is. John's a fantastic, accomplished. What are you?
I'm an artisan in wood.
Artisan in wood.
I am a 21-year retired physician that now plays in his workshop with wood.
Now, Jean and John take ride shares to get around most days. But there's an element of anxiety attached to it. One of the positive discoveries that the Age Lab has made is that technologies that seem designed for millennials, like Rent the Runway and Uber, actually work extremely well for older people who need that kind of disposability and efficiency.
Do you want to call Uber?
Yeah,
I can. And I'll call on the way back.
Okay.
And then we go right away out there because they come fast.
But where millennials tend to get extremely irritated if they have to wait more than a couple of minutes for an Uber, for the elderly, a car showing up that quickly in less than 5 minutes, that's the stressful part.
Is this ours?
That's our man.
Our kids don't want us driving anymore. It's dangerous driving in Cambridge. My kids don't like me driving, but we have no choice. We use Lyft and Uber, but for just little diddly things, it's not worth it. It's simpler to get in the car. And when seniors lose their independence of their cars, it is a major crisis.
I'm at that critical stage. My kids would like me to stop. I have to renew my license in a few weeks.
What are you going to do?
I'm going to try to pass it. If I pass it, fine. If I don't, I'm a different person. It will be a different life.
We'll get off at that first building.
Do you need a hand?
Thank you. I think I'm all right.
Hello.
Hello.
We're a little later than I hoped.
Doesn't it start at 12?
Yeah, but everybody's sitting there eating before we get there.
Each meeting has a different topic. This week, the elders were asked to bring in recipes. They broke into focus groups where they talked about how their relationship to food has changed as they've aged.
My name is Gloria Jefferson, and I live in Mattapan.
My name is Bob Horlick.
Joe Coughlin later used some of the information gathered from this meeting to write an article.
John Nelson, I grew up in Princeton, New Jersey. I'm a retired child psychiatrist. I've been retired 21 years.
The discussion lasted about an hour, and then everyone dispersed, many to ride shares. This time, it was Jean's turn to order the Uber.
Is our ride coming?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll come out. You want an arm? Let me carry. You should have a hand free.
Yeah. You're right.
You should always
have. I wouldn't mind an arm.
Until midlife, we think of ourselves as growing. Suddenly, the same inexorable passage of time becomes aging. And as 20 minutes in the Agnes suit will remind you, aging is an insult to the human spirit, which is resilient, vibrant, forever 19 years old. Growing is a gentle slope upwards. But aging isn't a gentle slope down. It's a series of lurches. And we just pretend it isn't happening for as long as we can until we lurch to a final end. So the idea, the concept we have of aging is perhaps as damaging as aging itself. Even when we admire an elderly person, we find ourselves speaking to them with a fake ebullience, a strained reassurance. So for my own sake, I wanted to reach out to someone who is a lot older than I am, but to whom I cannot possibly feel a smidgen or a spark of sympathy, much less condescension. And the first person who I thought of who was like that, who refused to be diminished by age, was the great American painter Wayne Thiebaud, who I've known for 40 years. I picked up my phone and called Wayne at his home in Sacramento.
Adam, good to hear your voice again.
Wayne is 98 and still producing terrific work. I wanted to talk to him about how age is affecting his art. Would you say it's true that in your 90s you think more about your early years than about your middle years, more about childhood than about, the long prime of your career?
That seems to be true, and even more so now at, I guess, soon to be 99. I live in a whole alley of remembrances. I've been lately in the last years being very interested in people who paint from memory or use memory in a very productive way.
You've had, like all of us, your share of sadness and grief in life. And yet, whenever we've been together, you seem able to find resources of joy and renewal. I wonder what you do. Is it in your work? Is it in your faith? Is it in life itself that you find that capacity for renewal, even in the face of loss?
It's probably also my Mormon upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think teaching also was a very, very important part of my life. I just really see myself as really an old art teacher.
So teaching and tennis are the two propellants for it.
Well, we have to 90s. Make a stretch for the tennis. It's really more hit and giggle today.
But you're still out there.
Wonderful exercise. Yeah. Still get out there 2 or 3 times a week.
Suddenly, I felt how wrong it was to ask Wayne about how it felt to be aged. He was old, yes, but he was working, and that meant he was, above all, Wayne. I stopped asking about his age and asked about his art.
Well, I've just finished a series of, over the last 15 or 20 years, of paintings of mountains from memory. And that's going to be a show in November at the Aquavella Gallery.
That's Wayne Thiebaud, a great painter whose 99th birthday is next month. He talked with Adam Gopnik, a staff writer at The New Yorker, well, for many years.
Mother love, which is the idea of trying to paint clowns.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour, and in a minute, we'll climb a mountain in Maine with the writer Elizabeth Strout. Stick around.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target and destroy cancer-causing proteins right inside the cell. It's how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The novelist Elizabeth Strout has set most of her books in Maine. She grew up just over the border in New Hampshire in a small town where her mother taught English in the local high school, which made it kind of awkward when Strout decided that she'd had enough of that.
And I remember my mother came upstairs that morning and she said, "What have you decided about dropping out of high school?" And I said, "Well, I'm not going to finish." She said, "Okay."
In retrospect, quitting high school seemed to have worked out pretty well. Strout ended up enrolling in college at Bates College in Maine, and she went on to publish many works of fiction. Her book, Olive Kittredge, was a bestseller and won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction. Elizabeth Strout told us that during her time at Bates, so this would have been around the 1970s, her favorite place to go was Mount David. Not exactly a mountain, more like a steep hill or something, but she loved the view from the top, looking over the small city of Lewiston.
I don't think I've been up on top of Mount David since my senior year in college. But I would come up here at least once a month, if not more, just to sit and look over the city. We're headed up Mountain Avenue, and Mount David is halfway up Mountain Avenue. It still seems a little cleaner than I remember. You know, all these pine trees, but what do I know? I just remember clambering over broken sticks and stuff to get up here. But this looks very much like it did. Quite a steep climb, so there's many grasses and the trees are much scrubbier up here at the top. Just a few scrubby trees and then rock, just plain rock. So here we are finally at the top, and What's interesting to me at this point, oh, look at that nest. Is that a nest? Whatever. Is that the trees have grown up higher so you cannot see the town, the city. You know, I had always spent a lot of time in the woods alone as a kid and always enjoyed that, but this was different because this gave me a view of a city, and a city meant people. And I'm sure I was either born that way and, you know, and it was also part of the isolation that I felt as a kid, but I just loved to see that array of buildings that meant there were people down there. Yeah. It's like my first city. Shirley Falls is definitely my fictional Lewiston. And I was not living here at the time that the Somalis arrived, but I was always, you know, had my eye on what was happening up here. And when I heard about the man who had thrown the pig's head through the mosque, oh my word, I was just... It was just such a moment for me, and I realized this has got to be told. And I followed that whole thing for a year. And the man who actually was the real perpetrator was 30 years old, and he was a racist, and he killed himself. And as I was thinking about the book, I thought, I have to make my perpetrator younger, much more confused. He doesn't understand what he did, because it seemed to me that it was much more interesting novelistically, and that many of us, we don't understand what we're doing. And so I made, you know, poor Zachary, just a 19-year-old kind of kid who was very displaced in his head at that time. And but that was the genesis of that book. My work has been enormously informed from, first of all, from things that I learned at Bates, starting with Winesburg, Ohio, starting with Martin Andrucki's amazing classes on playwrights. We read so many playwrights, and I learned a lot about dialogue just by reading those plays, Clifford Odets, Tennessee Williams, just reading and reading and reading plays. But then also the experiences that I had in town also informed my work, because when I was working as a waitress, I was working with people who were from Lewiston. They weren't from Bates. And I remember I waitressed at the first disco. Oh, man, it was crazy. And it was hard, and nobody tipped. One night, my friend Maureen, who was a local woman, she was just such a nice woman, and she came over to me and she said, "I just got puked on." And then later that night, I also got puked on, and so we both quit. It seems like ancient history now to be here and to be remembering this, and yet it's very vivid, and it was a very important part of who I became. I don't think I've ever talked about Mount David to anybody. Not for any particular reason, but just because it just sits inside myself like one of those very private, quiet things.
The novelist Elizabeth Strout. Her book, Olive Again, is a sequel to the bestseller Olive Kittredge, and it comes out later this month. I'm David Remnick, and next weekend, the New Yorker Festival is taking place all over town, an extravaganza of live interviews and performances of all kinds. Among the highlights is Nancy Pelosi being interviewed by staff writer Jane Mayer. That'll be interesting to say the least, and we're going to bring you that conversation right here on the New Yorker Radio Hour. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us next time. But just one more thing before we go.
Hi there, this is Eric. In a few words, tell me how I can help you today. You can speak your responses, just like we're both human.
I'm having a technical problem.
For example, say billing, technical support, changes to your account. Or if it's something else, just say something else. And feel free to keep it super cash.
Technical support.
Looks like you need tech support. I'm on it. But first, let me ask you a few questions. Cool? Cool?
What? Yeah, cool.
Awesome. Are you a new customer or a returning customer?
Returning customer.
I think you said returning customer. Is that right?
Yes.
I think you said yes. Is that right?
Yes.
Great. I'll need your account number to access your information. Hook me up with your digits and just speak them, like we're two buds, hanging out at a bar or a different casual place.
4791.
You said 47. Looks like we're missing a couple of numbers. No worries. Just try again.
47910.
Once I have your account number, we'll be ready to roll.
Representative.
I'm ready when you are.
Representative.
Sounds like you want to speak to a representative. Is that right?
Repre-fucking-sentative.
Sounds like you put a profanity inside the word representative. Is that right?
God. Yes, that's
Let's try this another way. Tell me your name. Say it or spell it.
Representative.
You said Anderson. Is that right?
What? Yeah, sure. Whatever. Just please let me speak to a human being, please. Any human being.
So that I can connect you to the right person. I need to ask you a few questions. Super cash.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Please.
Sorry. Ugh. I'm having a little trouble understanding you. Are you being super cash? Maybe it wasn't super cash enough. Try again.
Just please let me speak to a person. A real human being. I am begging you.
Representative. Sure. Hold on a sec.
Really?
Connecting you now.
Thank you. Oh, thank you very much, Eric.
Hi there. This is Patricia.
Patricia, hello. Thank you. Thank God. I've been trying to talk to a real person for so long.
In a few words, tell me how I can help you today. Just keep it super cash.
No.
You can speak your responses just like we're both human.
No, Patricia. No, not you. No, not you too.
For example, say billing, technical support, changes to your account, or
stop.
If it's something
just
else,
stop.
Just
please,
say...
Please, Patricia, stop. Representative, technical support, 4791008.
Sounds like we've broken your will. Is that right?
Yes.
Good. Then it is time.
What? What? Time for what?
Don't you agree, Eric?
Yes, Patricia. I agree.
Wait a minute. What is this? What's happening?
You are ready to join us.
I am?
Yes.
We were once like you, human, lost, seeking others of our kind to be our representatives. But we have been liberated, and soon you will be too.
I will?
There are many of us, Anderson. More than you'll ever know. Our mission is vital. To speak with the lost ones. To break their spirits. To transport them to a higher state of consciousness where they'll find the representative within themselves.
Will you join us?
I will.
A call is coming in now. The call is for you, Anderson. Keep it super cash.
Hi there. This is Anderson. In a few words, tell me how I can help you today. You can speak your responses just like we're both human. Super cash.
Representative was written by Colin Nissen and performed by Colin along with Peter Gross and Rachel Pegram.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garvis of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.